Accession number 12812, rule 4.
Rule 4. Getting back to the ship, the watch that had been ashore had come off at 4 to allow the next watch ashore 4 till 6. I got back aboard long before 6 because of all the trouble. And anyway, I was needed. Luckily, the watch had been ashore and had come off at 4, had been reasonably sober. In other words, they were able to stand watch. But what with the trouble ashore and the drunks, when they were coming aboard, they were incapable, see? Well, they should have all been run in, you see. But I think the Navy or the duty officer and the chiefs and what have you, to their wisdom, realised exactly what the situation was. So instead of applying Navy discipline ruthlessly, it had to be accepted that if a bloke was capable, it was all right, they didn't go to his mess. Those incapable, of course, did have to be separated and locked up someplace. Well, there's no brig aboard a warship, a destroyer, so we put them in the gun turrets. A gun, a 4.5 up top, has got a long tube down under up which goes the hoist and everything. And at the bottom where they come into the ship, there's a compartment with a lock on it. So I can see it now. Probably half a dozen drunks locked up in the gun turrets. You know, for their own safety as much as anything. And you know, the skipper, though, got rather het up about this because there weren't enough ratings to take the ship to sea. Well, the watch that was supposed to be standing down had to carry on, you know. And the only time I've ever been on a ship like that where the situation had got so bad, we could fight ship, we could have done anything that had been called on, but the whole routine was disrupted by reason of a run ashore, you know. But the Navy, in its wisdom, applies its discipline then as the situation demands, and that's what you should do. If you'd have run it by the book, the whole thing would have disintegrated completely. And it is accepted.
Mother? Now, coming on to the Arctic convoys, and can you tell me what your memory of service in those was, leading up to the famous action in which the VC was won by the Onslaught?
Being Captain D and a fleet destroyer, as opposed to an escort destroyer of convoys, the capacity within our particular ship was that of being able to fight a battle against superior ships, where convoy escorts were essentially U-boat hunters and killers, as well as ourselves, of course, when necessary. But the prime design of the O-class and P-class was essentially escorting fleet units, battleships, aircraft carriers, and were necessary, as we did in PQ or JW-54B, fight ship against superior odds, you see. So whenever we went to on a Russian convoy to Russia, we were expected to be able to fight German units, even as close escort, because no use the Germans coming out if they couldn't get to the convoy and sink the ships. That was the whole idea of the Germans. And our idea was, of course, to fight them off where possible. But, of course, the Germans had the U-boats and aircraft. And the thing is, though, that most of the Russian convoys were done in the winter, well within the Arctic Circle, Bear Island and Jan Mayen Island, well within the Arctic Circle, so there was no sunlight. There was twilight, which precluded the use of bombers out of Norway, but they did, early and late in the winter, do a lot of bombing, and particularly when the convoy turned down into Archangel and Murmansk. So Onslow, with most of its convoys, was close escort. In other words, you would get off the tiller of half a dozen destroyers, high-speed destroyers, 8 torpedo tubes, anti-aircraft guns, which in the winter were not used very much because there was little or no aircraft, but full patterns, 24 depth charges and things like that for submarines, but primarily keeping an eye on any German units that came out of either Narvik or any of the few naval bases that the Germans had in northern Norway. When we got into this trouble here, JW-51B, it was suspected that the Germans might want to come out onto this particular convoy. There was a lot of security, but by dint of reasonable assessment, both the Germans and ourselves had a reasonable idea of what the other was capable of doing. It was only a matter of putting things together and being confirmed by shore parties in Norway or long-range reconnaissance by the Germans. They could soon get on to any convoy going to Murmansk. The convoys would leave Lochue or the Clyde, and it would take them at least 3 weeks to get up to Murmansk. The escorts would meet them off Iceland, where the escorts had refueled. We would then pick up the dozen to 30 merchantmen carrying these armaments to Murmansk. The fleet itself in Iceland would leave probably a day, 2 days later. They would only go a third of the way, if that, on the route to North Russia, because beyond that, they were running great danger, not only from submarines, but from the Tirpitz and things like that. They were distant escorts as such, or distant fighting units ready to do anything that was called on. Then you had a screen of cruisers, long-distance operators with 9-inch, 6-inch guns, who would then be available should any units of the German fleet come out of northern Norway to attack the convoy. We left Seydisfjord in Iceland on Christmas Eve of 1942.
Was this JW-51 or 54? Well, it was called the Battle of the Barents Sea.
Battle of the Barents Sea. Yes, we, as I say, we left Seydisfjord, picked up the convoy the following day. I think it was 15 ships, going northeast, skirting Bear Island, and to the limit of the pack ice, which retreats a bit in the winter, comes down, strangely enough, in the summer. In part, and away we went for almost a week. We had been spotted by aircraft out of Norway, which immediately alerted the Germans, who then owned on U-boats to us. We sunk one. I'm sure it was that convoy. Anyway, we attacked one. I think it was confirmed later. We used almost every depth charge on a submarine that was trailing the convoy. One day, I remember that. Later on New Year's Eve, that would be GMT, because night and day up there when you're very much north means little or nothing. I remember we'd been closed up to defence stations, which was one stop below action stations, and it was around 5-6 o'clock in the morning and action stations went. Well, I'd been doing cipher work with the doctor, and we knew something was brewing. We had been warned to expect movements of one sort or another, and it had been confirmed that certain units of the German fleet had left northern Norway, and we could reasonably expect to be attacked. This was during the dark hours of the 30th, that's right. At about 7:30 on the 31st, we picked them up on radar. And I can remember now asking a signalman. I knew I had a bit of inside information from doing cipher work, but I remember saying to the signalman, just what is happening? He says, we've sighted them. Two or three of the German fleet are out. We should be at action stations within half an hour. First time in my life, I felt a pang of fear. What's fear? A drop of your tummy. A ache in your tummy. And it goes in a minute, because you've got work to do. You haven't time to sit around, you know. Doctor came, and we made sure everything was ready, made sure the after sick bay in the wardroom was manned and what have you, and just had to wait. Guns started firing. We knew nothing. And that is an awful thing, really. Because everybody was fighting ship, and they weren't there to tell us what was happening. We were on our own in the sick bay flat, waiting for anything that might happen. It's an awful thing. You can't do anything. There's nothing to do. Only sit and wait. And then this low banging going on. You know, it's your own ships. All the caulking comes off the deckhead, and where the ship has been painted on the inside, they paint cork in it to stop condensation and also to try and deaden sound. We had earplugs in, but I couldn't work with earplugs. You can't hear what's being said to you, so you take your earplugs out once you're really in action, you know. But the earplugs are supposed to stop the ears from being damaged by a concussion, of course. But Doctor and I were wondering what the hell's going on. Loud bangs, loud bangs. Then three loud bangs. Terrific. And the ship shudders. And I instinctively thought, my God, we've been hit. Because a bit different than your own guns firing. There's not a lot of difference, because you're on the inside of a 4.5s, it makes a hell of a bang, you know what I mean? Ship shudders on that. But these were different. Then suddenly, the place got filled with smoke. Coming up, just inside the sick bay flat was a ladder down to the mess decks, and down from the mess decks into the supply rooms, you see. And a rating came dashing up the ladder and started knocking the clips off the door to the upper deck, which we had to stop him, you see. And we're on fire. He was going spare, you see. Calm down. And, of course, by that time, the ship was on fire. I go into the sick bay to rescue anything that was available, or supplies or something like that. And all the bulkheads were ablaze. The electric wiring was going along. And we had to keep down on our knees because of smoke. A fire party arrived and got a hose going. Then it stopped for some reason or other. And your adrenaline's going. You're not afraid. There's too much happening to be afraid. I'm thinking I'm going to get casualties soon. And I wanted people to clear out, put the fire out and clear out. I grabbed a rating. Come on, put the hose in the sick bay. And he turns to me, and I realise it's the Lieutenant Engineer Commander. I said, I'm awfully sorry, sir. I said, I'm just sorry. Yes, he said, all right, leave it to us. And the fire more or less was put out in the sick bay, but there was fire down below. One or two casualties were coming up. and the doctor was there, gets the message that he's wanted on the bridge. Captain's it. MO to the bridge, please. So he disappears. Do what you can, Hanley. All right, sir, leave it to me. A body comes up the ladder, pulling himself up with his hands. He has one leg shot off and the other is shattered below the knee. And it's... the body coming up, most of his clothes blown off. I recognise him as the petty officer cook. And all the miscellaneous ratings in a ship, cooks and supply ratings and those and the typer and what have you, who are not gainfully employed in an action normally, they do go to supply parties, supplying ammunition, reserve sick bay parties and things like, in other words, fighting ship. He'd been in down below in charge of one of the, being a petty officer, in one of... charge of the shell supplies, which had been hit, you see. And he lost both legs, you see. Grabbed him, pulled him up, laid him on the deck. Just couldn't do a thing. I've made sure that the arteries that were fractured had tied off. You can't do a thing, because there are other casualties. But all you can do in a case like that, put a blanket under him, give him a shot, and in the Navy we had ampules of morphine and 50 millilitres, and just push it in and squeeze it. Put a mark on his wrist with a pencil that he's got a shot of morphine, so he's not going to be killed by morphine. If somebody else comes along, you see. So, couldn't do a thing for him. Another couple I treated for something minor. Then a message came from back aft. Sick berth attendant wanted back aft. Urgent. Casualties back aft. So I make my way along the upper deck. It's dark because there's there wouldn't be any twilight. That is about 9 o'clock in the morning. It wouldn't be twilight until 10 or 11 or something like that. And get down to the wardroom where the secondary sick bay was, in charge of a petty officer there. As the sick bay forward had been knocked out, and as the ship was on fire forward, all the activity had to be moved back aft. The ship was still being conned forward because Marchant had taken over from Captain Sherbrooke, who'd been put in his sea cabin. He'd lost his eye. Or a gun had hit, a shell had hit, I think it was a gun, and killed all the gunners there, and had sprayed the bridge with shrapnel. The lookouts were killed, and Captain Sherbrooke was injured with, he lost his eye. So the doctor was up there with him. I went back aft to find chaos, because what injuries were gathering there. They started bringing bodies up from forward where the damage was. A shell had hit the funnel and demolished most of the funnel, but the other two shells, the 9 inches, had hit one on the waterline, one on the funnel, and one on a gun. So the whole upper deck had been sprayed by shrapnel. There was a hole in the ship side, and the one on the funnel was nothing. It had... the scream of steam was all we got from that one. But the casualties were then brought aft. I had the job. Couldn't do much for the casualties as such. There were too many of them. The immediate job, was to get rid of the dead. One came along, a leading stoker, one of my own mess. Drop him there, put my head under his head, and my hand sinks into his brain. It doesn't affect you. It's too much going on. He's dead. Take him away. I want the living. I don't want the dead. Keep the dead away. So the lads themselves were able to tell whether a bloke was dead or not. One or two that were injured, we put them in the officers' cabins on the deck, and one or two in the wardroom. but it was also being sheltered by survivors as well, the wardroom and various bodies hanging around and things like that. Did what we can, and it gets very hazy from then on because there's so much happening, except another lucid moment with me. I'd filled the officers' cabins with the injured. There was one particular one, another leading hand. You would know all these men, by the way. On a small ship, you know everybody, you see. And being a sick berth attendant, you know them a bit more than the others, probably. But this bloke was not conscious, but he was alive. I couldn't tell what was wrong with him. There was not a sign of injury, apart from one or two shrapnel holes. And I try and examine him, see whether there was any bleeding, but there wasn't. I pulled his arm across, and suddenly a spurt of blood almost hit the ceiling, so I had to stop the artery off. He's not conscious. The situation with him seemed to be hopeless. He couldn't recognise anything or anybody. I eventually had to get to the doctor and say I got one or two people who I wasn't sure about. In cases like that, you can't do any serious surgery. There's nowhere to do it and nothing to do it with. The main thing is to alleviate pain by the injection and make sure they're marked, or to stop bleeding. Or if there's something like a leg hanging off, then try and support it somehow, and that sort of thing. Until things have calmed down, then the doctor himself, between us, we would assess what we are capable of doing. The sick bay was knocked out, so there was no access to any... Well, we didn't carry any sophisticated stuff. There was no resuscitation equipment or anything like that. It was essentially first aid, or life-saving first aid, and that was all one could do, and separate the dead from the living. Make sure that the living were as comfortable as could be expected, and to try and do something for those you felt had no chance. Under no circumstances was it my prerogative to even estimate. I had my own idea, but to me, anybody who showed sign of life was living, and that was good enough for me. And it had to be good enough for the lad himself. You never gave anything away, even though you felt it. There was a moment now, a lucid moment, when I'd gone along the cabins to inspect what casualties were there. The ship started to heel over. Now, I had no knowledge of what was happening on the ship. I was too busy. I knew we'd been hit, and I knew we'd been badly hit because of the fire, though, strange enough, we had power. Some of the places were under emergency lighting, like the sick bay that was, but back after we were, I think we had lights, so that wasn't too bad. But the ship began to heel over, and what had happened, they'd flooded the port side, and they pumped out the port side and flooded the starboard side to bring the hole on the side of the ship out of the water to stop her from sinking. I realised this in my limited experience, and as the ship was taking on, 15 degrees, easily, like that, you know, I thought, my God, we're going to sink. And I can remember still, I could almost take you to the exact spot when she started to go over. My God, what do I do if I get abandoned ship? What do I do with this poor bloke here? You can't stop to think like that. That immediately you've got to get rid of. You know, you act for the second that you live it. If the order have come to abandon ship, I don't know what I would have done. I think I do know what I would have done. I would have dragged this bloke out because he was nearest to me. I couldn't drag everybody out unless it was slow. But I had the insane idea, as badly wounded as this bloke was, of just grabbing him and taking him out with me. But you dismissed that, and luckily that situation pertained for quite some time until one realised you weren't sinking, and then you could carry on as you were. The next hours are very, very vague. The doctor was still concerned with the office, with the captain. I didn't see the doctor for a couple of hours, probably. I suppose he was doing forward work, I should imagine. Then we got together, and we were making sure that those who were alive were being looked after and done as much as we could. But you got to a situation you couldn't do any more. Without expert surgery, there was nothing you could do. Just make sure tourniquets were taken care of. The blokes, if they were lucid, are you all right? Now, what can I get you? Get them a fag or, you know, that sort of thing. Those that were badly injured, just hang on, you know, just hang on. Then, the next, I remember, for some reason, I looked at my watch, and it was 5:05. Now, we'd been on the go since 7 o'clock, actually in action since 7 o'clock in the morning. So that was 18 hours, roughly. And it gone like that. Don't remember eating. There was no lull for me, anyway. There was no such thing as going to have a cup of tea. But I do know that it must have been March, and with the captain's agreement, splice the main brace at midnight. And I said to the doctor, I said, Happy New Year, sir. He said, My God, it's the New Year. And he, like me, wondered where the hell the old year had gone to, you know. And we shook hands. And I remember having the rum. I was never overly fond of rum, but I liked to be one of the lads and, you know, used it for trading purposes. If somebody had a bit of something I wanted, or I would, come on, I'd give you gulpers and that sort of thing. That was how it was, you see. And I remember enjoying this top, and it gave me the warmth within inside of me that I didn't notice I was missing. We then settled down. I managed to get a breath of air on the upper deck, met an officer up there, and I didn't know who he was. He said something about, Are you all right? I said, Yes, sir. Went back to the sick bay. It was a shambles, all burnt, couldn't rescue anything, couldn't use it, you know, and did the rounds every few minutes or so, and for the next 24 hours, that was it. I think we got something. Oh, yes, the following morning, went down to what was my mess, the leading stoker's mess. And there were 3 or 4 faces missing. And that's when it hit the mess. There were 5 or 6 of us there. And we were almost afraid to ask, where's... And then nothing was said. Can't remember any conversation.